All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Delve into the visceral world of hip-hop with the Gangsta Chronicles, hosted by MC8 and Big Steel. It's every Thursday,
the
podcast that aims to unravel the intricate tapestry of one of music's most influential and misunderstood subgenres, gangsta rap.
Let's go.
Gangsta Chronicles unpacks the evolution of this uniquely American art form, offering listeners a comprehensive understanding of the significance this genre holds. Listen to the Gangsta Chronicles on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, y'all, this is Unpaid Bill from Team Supreme. We're back with part two of our QLS interview with Chris Robinson. In part one, Chris spoke about growing up in Baltimore and cultivating a career as one of the biggest music video directors of the 1990s and 2000s. He shared some secrets about working with Erykah Badu, Lord Tariq and Peter Guns, and LL Cool J. He also discussed his new project, Shooting Stars, which covers the upbringing of LeBron James. If you haven't already, please check out that episode. Now here's part two.
I want to hear if there's a way that you can give cautionary tales without compromising your position or your relationships and whatnot. But there's a theory that I have now at this stage of my life, which is I think when we turn 30 or 40, this is when we start to become experts. And I don't think it's more or less that we become experts more than I think in the first 20, 25, 30 years of our life, we take an assessment of, okay, this is pleasurable and this is painful. And so we basically want to just do the greatest hits and just take a compilation of all the pleasurable things and then apply that to it. And then we become experts. Like we know that, you know, if you touch the stove, you're going to get burnt. You know, if you walk across the street without looking both ways, you're going to get hit. So basically, you know, it's a compilation of life lessons. And then that's how you're supposed to proceed on from 40 and above. So for you, are there never again moments for directing in terms of, and I don't mean like I'll never work with this particular person again, but you already know that, like, all right, I can't double book.
Yeah.
That, like, what lessons have you learned that are like never again?
That's a crazy question. Just open my brain up. It's wanting the gig so bad that you compromise what your vision is. It has never, ever, 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 ever worked for me, right? And
so you've said yes to an artist before you even have a solid creative vision for it?
Oh, I've definitely done that, and that's worked out. That might be a timing thing, right?
All right.
But what I'm talking about is, like, you take this job, but you have to use this DP, and you have to shoot in this city, or you have to use someone or put a patina on it that we want it to be, right? Now, commercials are different, right? Because an ad agency works on that for a year before you ever get a phone call. So we understand their vision of what they're looking for. But when it comes to something creative, anytime I've attempted to do it, it didn't work or it wasn't satisfying. So my advice would be never compromise your thought for the money. You know, it just doesn't work. I have a dad thing. As I always tell my son, I go, Okay, when I was on JV, I could kick. Like, so we were just in practice and I was kicking, booming the ball. And the coach was like, Robinson, you can kick, you're a lineman. I ain't never seen a lineman kick. I go, yeah, I can kick. So he gives me the job. I'm kicking off. So before that, a coach comes up to me and he goes, hey, man, you're planting your foot all wrong. You got to put your foot closer to the ball so you can get more lift on. So here we go, our first scrimmage against our high school rival. And I go out, I listen to the coach, I plant my foot where he tells me, and the ball goes straight up and straight down. And I get fired. I'm no longer kicking the ball. And that to me is the metaphor of when I'm I'm in my flow. I know how to do this. I know the people I want to use because it's a business and an art form where you collaborate. Yeah. But then somebody tells you not to do what you do.
It's been working for you. Yeah.
Working for you and the reason you called me. Right. Because this is what I do. And I've done it a couple times regretfully because the opportunity was so big. And so when they come at you and they go, hey, man, this opportunity is big. You're going to do what we say. It's difficult to turn it down, you know, and if you have enough political acumen that you know how to twist it and turn it to still do what you want to do. Cool. I really don't have that gift. You know what I mean? I'm true to whatever that thing is. So I would say never, ever do that. And I know it's a difficult thing, you know, because right. opportunities are what they are. But I think that for me is the biggest one.
Are you the type of director, and I don't mean micromanage in that annoying way, like always over your shoulder looking. But for me, I feel like the editing is the most important part of your presentation. Mm. Like, because editing can be, I know for some would say, well, no, the story concept's the most important part. And some people would say, no, it's actually the look of it, like the art direction, the lighting. Some people could say the shot's the most important part. For me, I fall in love with the editing. I mean, a lot of, you know, 9 times out of 10, I'm working with footage that already exists already. So it's not like I have to shoot all my content. But in terms of storytelling, do you allow your lighting person, your lensman, your editors, do you give them free reign to do what they do? Or are you always over their shoulder from soup to nuts, like micromanaging what it is like?
I do, in that I'm giving everyone the vision. I'm going, hey, this is how I see it. Before we ever get out there on the playing field and before we ever roll 1 second of zeros and ones, it's not film anymore. So I always like to meet. I like pre-pro. I like setting down. I like looking at references. And I include the editor in that, right? I'll send the treatment. If it was a video, I would send the treatment to the editor before we ever shot, you know? And there were certain guys like Jeff Sellis, amazing dude. And he was like Scorsese's editor to me because I could give him, you know, when we were shooting 2 videos a week back in the day, I had to have trust, you know, to go, all right, here's this. I'm going to shoot this. When I get back, we'll talk. And Jeff, 90% of the time, you know, he would hit it, you know. So, but those kind of relationships are few and far between, right? So in videos, I work with like 4 or 5 different editors.
When you were in the eye of the storm of video making, how many videos? Well, you said a week. How many videos a month would you book?
Well, I know this. For 3 years in a row, I hit between 48 and 50 videos.
Wait, say it again.
For 3 years in a row.
Right.
I know this because that's when I had left Partisan, left HSI, and I had my own company. I did between 50 videos a year to 50, probably like the year I did the most videos were like 56. So that was doing like about a video week.
Yeah,
and I had 3 rotating producers who only worked with me. I had about 5 rotating editors and my executive producer, Roseanne, which I told you earlier is wild. She really managed all that well. And it was, go ahead, Chris, get on a plane, go. And I would have to show up and do my job. And I, you know, it was such a beautiful time that we were able to do it and still keep the integrity of the art, right? Because I was big on that too.
No and, vacation, you know, no vacation, Christo, in 3 years.
Now, let me tell you, I was upset if people wanted to take a vacation. I
remember.
Listen,
you are the roots.
I had this guy, Michael Lucero. I don't know if you guys know.
I know this name. Yes.
Yeah, Michael Lucero was amazing. He's passed. You know, rest in peace. Michael Lucero did 93 Till Infinity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. He did Bustin' Dirty. And when I first had a company interested in me, which is where I met Roseanne, she was the executive producer of his company. It was called What You See Is What You Get. And they were in San Francisco. So I flew out from Baltimore to San Francisco, met them, and the whole nine. Well, he was such a good dude. He was kind of like a, you know, one of these guys who climb mountains and, you know, kind of that kind of dude, but an amazing director.
As you can see in that video. Okay.
Yeah. Learned a lot from him. Learned a lot from him. Learned how to write treatments, but such a good man. But he, every year, he would take us on vacation. And if we were going to Mexico, he would take the company on vacation. And the first year I was there, I wasn't really, you know, getting a lot of work. And I was pissed that they wanted to take a vacation. And he wanted to fly me and pay for it, pay for my room. And I did not go. And I was like, who's taking a vacation? We need to work. So I was a little over-indexing, I would say, back then, because I wanted it so bad. And, you know, there's great photos that Robin Frank, who was my rep, has sent to me recently, like, of that trip that I missed.
That you could have been.
That right. I could have been at, you know. What I was sitting at home in Baltimore kvetching about, you know, not working instead of like going on vacation. Exactly.
So can you walk me through the process? Because I'm learning now that in order to be creative, you should really dedicate, or at least for me, what works for me is a lot of silence.
Mm.
A lot of solace, a lot of silence. I used to be the type of person that sort of reveled in chaos.
Right.
But yeah. I realized, like, like during the pandemic, then every idea came to me and suddenly inspiration came. So, okay. So in the eye of that storm. So, all right, let's go to 2005. Okay.
Right.
Like, how long do you sit with? And I'm going back to videos because I feel like videos are harder than movies because you basically have 4 minutes to tell a story and really knock it out the park. So what is your process? How long do you sit with a song? Do you sit with a team of people and think of ideas? Do you look at the physical build of the person? Do you get to know them and see if they're athletic, if they know how to run, if they know how to drive a car, like what they're in? Walk me through the basic. Like, how long do you sit with a song before you suddenly see what it is?
It for music videos, man, it's different. It depends on what the song truly inspired me, right? So a script will inspire you, but the song really would inspire me. For instance, you know, when I heard, you know, I received Noriega song. What?
So,
Super Thug. I got Super Thug. I wrote that in 20 minutes because I had this idea about camels in the desert, and it'd been around for a long time in my head. It was rolling around in my head. So I wrote that, and it's funny because my rep was like, "This is the quickest treatment you've ever written. Are you sure you want me to turn this in?" And I was like, "Yeah, this is it." Because I was a little notorious for sending in a treatment late because of exactly what you're describing of taking your time.
Living with it.
So when I did, I received You Don't Know My Name from Alicia. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting in the house.
It's a good one.
8 hours just listening to it. And I kept almost getting it. Then I flew to LA and I had an assistant. Her name was Nia Andrews. She's in music. Like, her dad was in, he wrote "Aw, Freak Out." Like, he's part of that legacy. So we drove around LA for 8 hours. I remember we went to Malibu. We just were listening to this song on repeat. And then later that night, she called me and she goes, "Well, what about, you know," and then the idea. So she, it would ping pong back and forth. So there's some things I would do totally solo. There's some things, Jesse Torero used to be my assistant, good brother, and one of my best friends. And he may come up with something. Neil Feldman was an assistant of mine, or I'd give him the outline and do it. But about, I'd say a good 70% of the time, it was just me dipping out. You know, I got a house in Maryland, sitting on the back porch and playing it in the headphones and just vibing. And sometimes that could take me 2 days, 3 days.
Can I just say, since you mentioned the Alicia Keys video, did you have everything in your head, even the casting of that video, when you were thinking of the concept of "You Don't Know My Name"?
And did Mos Def show up on time?
Listen, I don't remember. I remember. I don't remember.
You remember. Yes, you do.
Listen, he's an artist, brother. He's a guy. Right. Never on schedule, always on time.
But did you think so in your mind, is that, did that come out the deck directly way you wanted it, the players and everything, or that just came later?
I really truly can't remember how Mos became involved. But Alicia's very, she still is, and she was, she lives that whole complete life, right? So she wasn't just down for some video model, you know, coming through. She wasn't down for people all up in her mouth, kissing her, you know, even no matter what the concept was. She was very focused on, you know, being authentic, telling the story, but also being respectful in her life versus just the art. And I've known Mos through my boy, Seth Free, another Philly cat.
Yes.
For a minute.
Seth Free. Yes.
Seth Free. Shout out to Seth Free. And I just truly can't remember, but when he came through, I was so happy because I loved the movies he'd been in, and he was down. You know, it was not a lot of money involved in it or anything like that. He just came through and represented. And, you know, I still think that video, I should create a movie. I love Frankie and Johnny, Al Pacino. I think it would be so dope to, you know, do that. And we shot at Pan Pan in Harlem. And Pan Pan's not there anymore, right? So that brother made the best
sandwich. I miss Pan Pans.
Yeah, Pan Pan was dope.
Oh, wait. I miss it, man.
So since you mentioned that, Chris, what's another video you feel that way about that you could have just continued on and it could have been a whole, like, movie?
There's a few.
What, Break You Off? No, I'm playing.
Hey, Chris, did Break You Off too? It's too many videos.
Chris did so many videos, I forgot he did my video. I'm sitting here like, wait a minute. I think Chris directed the Roots video and I just, oh, shit. Because when you said The Wire, I was like, wait a minute. A couple of Wire cats are in my video for Break You, and then...
That's right. But I produced that video. Jesse Torero directed that video. So I was there, and we did the thing under the bed and the whole joint, but it was, that was dope. I loved that video.
You know, the era of kind of the big budget videos just kind of pretty much evaporated. Mm. How did you and the other directors, how did y'all transition during that period?
Went to movies.
Listen.
What was that like, man? Kind of seeing that ecosystem just kind of dwindle.
You are, man, it's such a great question. And
is YouTube your Napster?
Oh, yeah. Napster's my Napster. Because Napster is the reason the video budgets disappeared, too. And I'll tell you, man, I wish I could say I saw it coming, but we did not. And I remember literally there was like a week where the bottom dropped out. I think fortunately I'd already like maybe started working with Kevin on Real Husbands or whatever it was. But, you know, my bread and butter it was chopped at the knees. And it was very much like, I almost thinking it was a joke at first. Like, you know, labels would call and go, yeah, we got X. And I'd be like, really? Now, okay, so what is it really? Because you know who, you know this artist and what they, you know, the budget you're telling me is what they need for their, you know, writer. Right. You know, like what this artist is. So I think, you know, for me, it was just a very difficult switch, but I started to understand it. And I actually would call people. I'd call all the people I met over the years and go, like, yo, what's going on? Like, what's happening? Like, I didn't understand the ramifications of Napster and digital and all that stuff. I was still going to the record store getting CDs.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
See, I think, in the music business, many people look at Usher's Confessions as the last album of that era. I mean, it was the last album of, it's the last brick and mortar album where it sold 10 million units.
Wow.
And then, you know, like it came out in 2003, and then the age of ripping and all that stuff really came into play. But
right.
I also feel like I have a theory that maybe for the video world, even though it wasn't financially responsible, I kind of feel like the Rock the Boat video really marked an end, even though other opulent videos were made kind of after. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the effect of the Rock the Boat video and kind of what it represented, like just the whole thing with Aaliyah's death, flying to other locations, private planes, big budgets, on a boat, on a yacht, I definitely remember a moment where that just kind of paused the whole entire industry for a second. So even though it wasn't like a direct thing where it's like, you know, like a 9/11 thing that changes the world, or a January 6th thing, like where you can literally see a tangible thing. But I kind of always wanted to know, like in the video world, was that a moment that gave you personal pause?
Like your soul, like your soul was like put on pause. Mm-hmm. And I think we all had been moving at 100 miles an hour for so many years and have had all these relationships and were so deeply entrenched in, you know, going for excellence that we didn't realize the, you know, how precious life is, right? Because we so indexed on working. An example is when the pandemic happened and I was home for 3 weeks and I was bugging out a little bit. I realized that I hadn't been anywhere for more than 2 weeks for 20 years. Right. So I had to stop moving around, and I'm sure you guys went through that same thing.
Oh, yeah.
And to your point, you know, when that video happened and all those things happened, there was a real, the party almost stopped, right? There was a halt in, because we all felt like Aaliyah was our little sister, or little cousin, and we loved her. It was a different kind of a feeling when that happened. And, you know, we're all jumping on planes and jumping on private planes and we're moving, you know, I've been to Brazil to shoot, and we never really took, we never thought about it, about safety and what could happen. And I think, look, that's just something that happens in life. And I think it just was business as usual for us to achieve a great art form. I think we're hyped. I think that video is beautiful. And I think, of course, like, you know, Hype himself as an artist wasn't only a music video director, he was like our North Star, and he was tight with these artists and had relationships with these artists in a way where, you know, a Hype Williams video could change your life as a musical artist, right? And it just felt like all of our business, all of our craft took a moment to breathe in when that happened. So I agree with you, man. It was tragic and beautiful at the same time.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte, Fontigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? Well, no, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I always wanted to know, if you can name a name, what artist always makes you go back to the drawing board and redoes? Like, for me, I will say that I was in a situation when I know never to give the song that I want to give Jill Scott or Erykah Badu as the first song. Like, I actually create, and sometimes Tariq, like, it's almost like I have to do a horse and pony show. Like, all right, here's the song, and it's not the song. And then I'll do a second song. All right, I tried hard. Here's the song. And then I'll do the song I really want to give you. All right, here's the song. They're like, yeah, this is the one. So is there an artist that always makes you go back to the drawing board to read, I don't like this treatment, I don't like this treatment? Or where you have to explain to them, like, in other words, okay, well, I guess with the Honey video, and you said Erykah, you didn't say she's micromanaging, but, you know, I know.
No, I am not saying she's micromanaging. She is an amazing artist.
Yeah, we're going to recreate these classic album covers, which looks good on paper. But
absolutely,
what artist, like, makes you always go back to the drawing board because they just don't see it in the paragraph that you're explaining?
But it's a good challenge. It's a good challenge.
Yeah, no.
Challenge.
I immediately know two artists. One is Busta Rhymes.
That's a good challenge.
Busta Rhymes is a visual. You want to talk about somebody who's paying attention to the visual? I mean, and wants to call you at 2 a.m. because he's on that time as a musician in the studio.
You're gone. I don't understand.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't understand why you didn't pick the phone up at 2 a.m. Like, he is, you know, to his credit. I mean, look at, I just, on his tribute, I was looking at the Janet Jackson video that he did. And that thing is crazy. Just, Wuha, everything he does has a visual component to it. So what happens is he likes the first treatment too, but then you get there and he's in the details. He's going classic Busta Rhymes and Bust, I love you, you my man, and we already know what it is, classics only. But when we did Pastor Cavassier, that was each setup was a conversation. Like he Diddy's fight scene, he felt was better than his fight scene. And he wanted to re-choreograph the fight scene to make sure that it's his video. So I get it. So we re-choreographed that fight scene in that room. Now, at the time, when the clock is ticking and you're gonna go into overtime, and you've written the treatment, and you've done the costume design, and you've got all the martial artists who are going to be in it, and you have the moment, that seems like a request that is gonna be tough to create. But it doesn't matter, because we still did it. And when you look at that video, when I look at that video, I go, wow, we probably had 65% of that on paper, 65% of that planned. And what Busta will do is, he's not just making arbitrary requests. He's so deep in it that he's pushing you. He's pushing for greater. He's pushing for better. So he's not the guy who just disappears and goes and smokes. He's on the set, sitting in the director's chair, looking at playback. And as you're moving through your day, as a director, you know, there's certain time things you have to hit. But interestingly enough, I think we did shoot like an extra 8 hours on that video.
So do you already have overages written in the budget? Do you already have overages written in the budget when you know?
That is what you try to do, right? And then, like, once again, my executive producer, Roseanne Cunningham, that's what you try to do. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, you cannot predict some things. Now, the tough conversation that I've seen many times is when the producer goes over to the, you know, music video rep and goes, okay, we're having this, it's this much time, or Chris wants a crane, the crane broke and we have to bring in another one, whatever that is, the record label has to sign off to say, okay, you know, cost plus, if the crane costs you another $10,000, we'll pay for it. And usually that's where the power shifts, right? Because the power shifts because we already have a contract.
Right.
So no matter what happens, I need to do what's on this treatment to fulfill the contract to get paid. Like, that's just a reality of the business that is really the only way that you can do it, right? Yeah. You have to make sure that it's done, but there's extenuating circumstances that I've seen over the years. But if the artist and the label are like down with you, right? You can change things a little bit to accomplish the same goal. But, you know, I think Busta is you know, he understands it early. He understands, like, okay, this, even if this treatment is we've got to move quickly, so this treatment is a blueprint, we're going to get it where it needs to be once we get there. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. I vow to never do this on this podcast, but since you're here, I got to know the politics of video joins. Come on now.
Got agencies now.
There's entire careers and Instagram accounts
King
that have made legends out of the right 7 seconds in a video.
Is that still a thing? Is that still a thing, though, y'all think? That feels like an error.
I don't think videos are.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Ain't no more Esther Baxter. You know what I'm saying? I'm thinking of like.
Yeah, right. So, but the thing is that by this era, you know, even video models have just as much leverage as the artists themselves. And so how do you wrangle, like, and I'm not trying to objectify like their product placement, but is it written ahead of time? Like, okay, I'll make sure that, you know, when you're wrangling with her manager, whoever it is.
Ooh, Gloria Vallis. She was a good one too.
Like, dude, that when Grace was at Jive, like Grace was responsible for like from Kareen all the way down, like all those videos. So, but she told me that she was there to not only wrangle, but also to protect them. You know what I mean?
But
I didn't realize that there's like negotiations where this particular artist has a certain cachet and she wants to be featured and da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, a feature girl
Is that just decided, or is it random, or is it already pre-planned at the gate? Like, okay, we'll make sure that you're the featured and we're not going to feature your rival that you might have beef with in said video, or is it just like up to the artist who gets in or not?
No, listen. In my experience, it's always been, this is going to be a boring answer, it's always been like casting on a feature film. Now, you would think like, oh, that's kind of random. You know, or you look at it and you go, that must be random. Where'd they get all those girls from, a club? No. The answer is there's a casting director, Ulysses Terrero, Jesse's brother, is one of the best that ever
did it. Okay.
And, you know, in that point, there was an era where those young ladies that were, you know, video vixens or whatever you want to call them, it was a portal, right? So now you decide, you know, like there's very memorable moments of different video vixens in videos, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but then it's literally a portal. Like think about every actress who does Shout outs to Melissa Ford. I mean, you want to talk about the Hype Williams of video vixens? Like she was dope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that Jadakiss video, Knock Yourself Out. Like she's amazing. But let's talk about her, the portal. Now she is in another part of the business. Now she does podcasts. Now she was, you know, part of that era with the magazine with Daytuan Thomas and creating
King. Yeah, shout out to Daytuan.
King.
You know what I mean? And then let's talk about Lauren London. The first thing she did was she was Paul Hunter's assistant, number one. She was in Drop It Like It's Hot, which is a music video. She was in Pharrell's video. And my assistant at the time, brother named Carl Reed, they were friends. And he goes, Chris, you should audition Lauren for ATL. And I said, absolutely not. No way. I'm not having a video girl. I'm trying to be a serious filmmaker. But he was like, look, man, you gotta just be a good brother, man. You gotta give her a shot. She wants to be an actress. And she came in, and it's a great story because she came in and she was late. We had packed the film equipment up, right? She came in and she goes, I gotta pee. Can I go to the bathroom? So she delayed us further by
good
having
start.
To go to the bathroom. Okay. So I'm just sitting there looking at Carl like, okay. And we said action. And I had been looking for Nunu for probably 8 to 10 weeks.
Wow.
And it was her.
Wow. Was it true in ATL that a lot of big boys' lines, did he improv a lot of that, or how did that work?
Because I wanted to ask about
it. Right.
Let me tell you something. When he said, you didn't do that money in my face. The whole thing was like, try not to laugh. Big Boy is genius with his ad libs. And the way Big Boy was moving was, you know, he's Big Boy. He's from Outkast. Mm-hmm. He didn't really understand, you know, oh, it's a 6 a.m. call. You have to be there, all these things. and he would come directly from the studio to set.
Okay.
Not having slept or whatever it was. And every day I'd be worried. Every day he delivered. Every scene, you know, he always added that extra something that was beyond the script. Yeah, he ad-libbed a lot of that stuff, and he's a dick.
How was it with T.I.? Because that was him. I don't think that was his first. Was that his first feature?
It was.
It was. How was it working
first
with him?
Acting role.
Time after, yeah.
It was similar in the fact that he wasn't, he never worked on a set before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, me and him, I did his very first video. I'm serious. Before,
before track music. Yeah.
Exactly. So so I was always like, man, this kid is dope. And Dallas Austin was like, I think T.I. could really play this role. So Tip would, I think he came in the first day in a Rolls Royce. And he came to set, he pulled up for the set with his Rolls Royce. And then he had a big, like, you know, when it's a movie, it's Favored Nation. So every actor has the same kind of a trailer. Mm-hmm. And then he had his own Winnebago. And all the other actors were in like a two-bang. So, mm-hmm. you know, I talked to him and I said, brother, you know, you're leading this. Like, this is, everybody's looking to you. You are number one on the call sheet. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in our other world, in your music world, because he's in the studio every night too, he's super popular. He's becoming the king of the South. I just had a conversation with him and we just got on the same page about work ethic, coming in, being the leader, because we're all looking to you as the lead in this picture. And, you know, I think the hardest part for any artist is not being T.I. or being Tip to your audience, being Rashad, mm-hmm. who is in high school, a guy who just got out of high school, who has got to show vulnerability. But I think what we both learned for each other, because both of our, you know, you can never do your first movie again, right? So everything was bet on Tip for me. Everything for Tip was bet on me. Like, so we both had to, you know, we're going to win the Super Bowl. The quarterback and the receiver better be connected. All references. So, you know, I think we did a good job. I think it's, you know, people still reference it and still love it. And I watched him turn into a superstar. That's the one human being I watched turn from a really hot commodity into a superstar through that process.
That's what's up.
Yeah. How did you know that Evan Ross was right for that role?
You know what? He came in the audition. I didn't know who he was. I met him in Los Angeles, and I didn't know he was Diana Ross's son until we were shooting.
Okay.
Really good.
But yeah, I just was. Evan has a restaurant out here now. Evan's doing good, man. Evan's grown up.
What's the name of his restaurant?
Leona's.
Okay, thank you.
Leona's. It's on Ventura, and he has a club called Warwick on Sunset.
Didn't know that was his. See, people would look at Evan Ross and they're like, what is he doing besides being married to Ashley Simpson? That's dope.
Counting his money.
Well, can I ask about your audition?
I have one more question about videos.
Mm-hmm.
And be honest about the mind state of directors. I know you're saying I can only speak for myself.
Right.
But half the time, do you guys already have treatments in your head? Or stock footage pre-shot already that you're just waiting for the right artist to sell that on?
No.
Like, in other words, is every video a bespoke kind of customized video? I'm only asking this because, you know, I had a situation with, I don't know if you know who Sanji is.
Of course.
He did Far Size Pass Me By.
Yep.
And
amazing.
Always wanted to work with Sanji. And we finally got a chance to work with him on our Tipping Point record. And my manager was always like, something ain't right here. Like, why do I feel like
hold up? Wait a minute.
We did the Star video.
Oh, I was wondering which one. Okay.
And Rich is like, why do I feel like he shot this video already and just basically sold us a bit? Because the thing was, we weren't there for it. When you talked about shooting your B shots without the artist first, I was like, wait a minute. That might be a Sanji trick. In which it's my manager, Rich Nichols, rest in peace. It's his assessment that we got and basically like he had already shot the video already and sold it to us. And he just shot our shots like at the end for a day or whatever. But like, do you do stock shooting of stuff, you know, like neighborhood shots or just random things that doesn't have a home yet? Is that a thing?
No, I listen. In my experience, no, I'm just kidding.
You got to go watch this video again, Chris. I think they might have got Amir might be right.
Look, I think everything is bespoke for every director. One reason is, you know, the label owns everything. So right. When we would finish a video, you would see 2,000 feet of it, but we'd send the whole 20,000 feet of film to the label. So I don't know if and that's when we were shooting film, but the label owns everything, period, point blank. But
yeah, but I mean, like,
right. Okay.
Back in the day, like all my reels go to the label, but now if I turn in a record, right. I'm just turning that record. They're not getting the demos and the stuff that didn't make the record.
Right.
They're supposed to.
Here's what's funny. I always talk to my producer and I say, you know what we should do? And it's exactly what you said. I said, when we shoot a video, why don't we have this concept? Because let's say this. For every video you shoot, you wrote there's five videos I didn't get, right? Mm-hmm. I'm battling Hype, Benny. We're all battling each other. So for every video I did, there were five concepts that are sitting on my shelf. I always thought it would be a genius idea to shoot all the components of a video and then put the artist in it. But you never really could do it because everything has a certain vibe. Every song has a certain vibe. Like I said, I thought that would be a great, great idea. And maybe artists would like it where you could go, hey, here's a video and here's how we would insert you in it. I always wondered that. Never had the opportunity to do it, but
you should watch this video.
Watch Star because
I hate Roots videos.
I just rewatched it. I was like, wait.
Really? Shut up, Laia.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Delve into the visceral world of hip-hop with the Gangsta Chronicles, a podcast that aims to unravel the intricate tapestry of one of music's most influential and misunderstood subgenres, gangster rap. Hosted by MC8 and Big Steels every Thursday, each episode provides an in-depth exploration into the formative artists, monumental albums, and socio-political factors that have shaped gangster rap from its emergence in the 80s to its enduring impact today. Gangsta Chronicles unpacks the evolution of this uniquely American art form. We dive into the socio-cultural aspects that gangster rap boldly addressed, from police brutality to systemic racism, offering listeners a comprehensive understanding of the profound cultural significance this genre holds. Listen to the Gangsta Chronicles on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Let's go.
Anyway, let's talk New Edition, please, so we can wrap up.
I just wanted to know about New Edition as a director. From your vision, first of all, what were the, you have to have these things in place for you to direct this project. You have to have power over this. Like, did you have any of those moments
for New Edition? Wait, can I ask something to your question?
Yeah. Okay. Before, please.
All right, you remember how the guy who did the Bel Air thing, like, actually pitched?
Yeah.
Hey, why don't we do a dramatic? And he did like a sizzle reel or a fake trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There was once a fake trailer for the New Edition biopic that was like roaming on you in the early days of YouTube, like back in 2006. Yeah. Did you have anything to do with that?
I did not.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I met the brother.
All right. Okay.
I met the brother. And let me tell you what else. He showed up on set with Maurice Starr.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. He came. So look, God bless him. That's a Hollywood lesson, man. Like I've been the same way early in my career. Like, yo, I'm just going to shoot this sizzle. And then they'll know that
I'm the guy for the job.
I did it. 7-8 years ago, I shot an ATL 2 trailer.
Uh-huh.
I got everybody together, paid for it. Me and Tip.
Yo, I remember saying right? it. Yes. Okay.
We're trying to you know, create momentum. So, you know, studio would say, hey man, yeah, we'll make it. You know, it was an effort to, you know, show all those people together again. So nothing has come of it as of yet. We hope that we can make ATL 2. But mm-hmm. I do remember that quest, and I met that brother, and he was a young director, and he was really dedicated to wanting to make that happen. And, you know, I didn't have anything to do with it, but I do know that he got so far as he showed up with Maurice Starr.
And what did they want?
No, Maurice Starr, of course, we invited him to set.
Okay.
You know, to see. To watch, but he was there with him, and I actually had a conversation with him.
Ooh, his heart must have been so broken. Oh Lord, yeah.
It's tough. It's tough, but that is a Hollywood 101 lesson that's hard to get. But I think he's still pursuing the art. He's still pursuing directing, and I think it was dope for him to do that. Right, he had the love. And he just kind of, he came up with it and he goes, I'm going to do this. The fact that he made that happen, and I got to go back and look at it. But I remember thinking, this is pretty good. You know what I mean? Before I was ever involved in any New Edition project.
I kind of thought that was the impetus that allowed this to happen, because that thing was so viral that about a year or two later, then it was like, yo, we're really going to make this happen. I thought he was a part of that. So.
No, you know what? I knew about this project. Jesse Collins produced it.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. Jesse told me about this maybe 7 years before we shot it.
Okay.
Right? He had the project, obviously, you know, he does BET Awards and everything. And so he got with them. So you can imagine, in order to develop it with all those human beings to do the life rights and to come together, it took that long. So about 7-8 years later, I remember the New Edition was my first concert. 15, Spectrum, Philadelphia. I went to see New Edition, Lisa Cult Jam. I think it was the Fresh Fest. And, you know, stole the car from my parents, did the whole thing. So,
you can't just casually say that. What?
Yeah, that was my first concert as a kid. Like, I loved New Edition, is my point.
Did you get away with it?
I did not.
what was the punishment?
I didn't steal the car. I took the car when they told me no. And I drove all my cousins up there.
Worse.
It's bad. We got the car towed. One of my uncles had to drive from Maryland to Philadelphia to get us. It was silence on the way back. It was worse than Vanessa on The Cosby Show.
I was just thinking about that episode. Literally think about that episode.
It was
we'll explain, Bill and Steve. Go ahead.
I watched The Cosby Show.
Hey.
What was right, your question about New Jamaican. Edition?
It was, oh shit. What was your question about New Edition?
Oh, did you get away with it?
No, did not. Did not. But when I finally did it, I made sure my uncle and my dad got to see it. And they were like, okay, it was worth it. You know what I mean?
How long was your initial treatment? Because I'm almost certain it was the three-parter, right?
Three nights, 2 hours.
I'm almost certain that you had enough content for almost an entire week. Like your original vision, how long would it have been?
Well, the script, it was, the original script was one big script, right? It was like 160 pages. And then Stephen Hill and BET said, look, we want this to be like an event. We want this to be three nights. So the writer Abdul, who's amazing, we started that process. So Jesse told me about it 7 years prior. All those 7 years, I was like, man, I wish I could do that New Edition movie. And then he asked me, would you be interested in doing this? I was like, yes. So it's interesting because this was 2015-16. I just decided to move back to the East Coast. So I had a house out here, the whole thing. We shut the house down. You know, gave up the lease, and I was headed to the airport when he called me to say, would you want to do this movie? It's a green light with BET. We start next week. So I had to change everything that I was doing, stay out here. And, but so then it happened, and then we worked for maybe 6 months before we started shooting. So I think one of the questions was, how did we pull all those actors and whatnot together? And that was a real casting thing with Robbie Reed. We'd have Robbie Reed, Spike Lee's casting agent for years and years.
We got to get her on the show.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's amazing. And it's just so for each person, like Woody, McClane, who's now, you know, doing his thing.
Yeah.
He's killing him.
Yes.
He used to be a dancer for Chris Brown.
What? Wait.
Okay. He was a dancer for Chris Brown before he had ever acted in anything. So I had called Fatima Robinson to go, hey, do you know anybody who I'm looking for Bobby Brown? And she gave the reco for Woody. Then we saw Woody, and Wood was really like, he was a dancer, so he wasn't used to acting. He was rather shy. But he could dance his ass off. He could do all the Bobby Brown stuff. And we had the conversation, and I just was like, listen, I'm going to bring you back for like the third audition. Be bold, brother. Like,
he's not an actor. He's not an actor. What?
And then he's, but look what he's done.
Yes!
Like, that's what I always say. Like, you know, that's something that me and Jesse Terrell always said. Like, a lot of times we weren't able to work with the big actors in our career. Like, they weren't checking for us as directors. They always looked at us as video directors. So we said, let's make our own star, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that we, you know, had that kind of blockade, because it spawned other things.
Because he was Bobby for a long time, to the point where when he got to Power, I was like, I don't know, but now he's Kane. He is Kane.
He did New Edition, and then he did the Bobby Brown stuff.
Yeah.
He killed it.
I feel the same. I guess you must have felt very strongly about Algie in that way, the actor that played Ralph Tresvant, because you've circumvented him back into a couple of projects, right? At least I know he was in Shooting Stars.
Yeah. No, listen, it's always a curveball, right? I was like, I didn't, I didn't see it. I didn't see Algy as Ralph Tresvant. Because there were people that looked a lot more like Ralph Tresvant.
I could see that, yeah.
And I didn't see it, but then Jesse really believed in it. And I was like, okay. And then when he came to the part in the audition where they would sing, Algy can sing. And I was like, I was torn all the way up until we were shooting. And then he did it. Like, he killed it.
So even pre-shooting, you still weren't sure?
I wasn't sure. Because we had let this guy go that I'm talking about. If there was a Ralph Tresvant twin,
mm-hmm.
but obviously Algy embodied the character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he had a sensitivity. No pun intended. he could dance, he could sing, and even the tone of his voice was just perfect.
I need something specific from you, Chris. I'm so sorry.
Yes.
And
as
you're telling these stories about this casting, I need you to please tell the story of why you casted Dustin Felder for Jimmy Jam. May he rest in paradise for fucking ever. Like,
please. Listen, Dustin Felder. He was our acting coach for the kids.
Oh, wow.
Kids, right?
Yes, yeah. That's what he does.
Was our acting coach. His energy was just grounded and real, like the exact kind of person that the way I wanted to communicate to the boys. And we would have sessions where I would just be in a corner quiet, and the way he spoke to them and the way he talked to them about performance and being real. You watched them more, because these were all guys who were kind of afraid, right? Because not only is this material tough, the real guys are visiting the rehearsal.
Right.
Like, they did the dance, like, they
intimidating,
came,
right?
You know what I'm saying? And then what Dustin would do would be amazing. And we were looking for, like, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, and I would look at him every day and go, man, you could be Jimmy Jam. You know what I'm saying? Like, you could do it. And we'd laugh about it. And then one day he wore a fedora. And I go, it's
wow,
a man.
Wow.
It's him. Let's go.
Yes.
And all the boys were, like, campaigning for him too. Like, all the guys who were played New Edition, they were campaigning for him too. And it was a natural fit, man.
He's really coached some amazing Black actors out of LA. Like, there's a generation of Black actors that have a lot to give to him. So, and he's from Philly. And he's a Philly man. He's a Philly guy.
Oh, well, I didn't even know that. That's what's up. Good brother.
I heard a rumor that you were you one of the initial actors that, I guess for a long time, both Will Smith and Kevin Hart were going to do Uptown Saturday Night? Did I not hear your name tossed in there as a director?
I'm glad you're telling me, because I heard about that project too. I think Will Packer was involved in it. And that's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Wow.
Movie of all time. Yeah. And a few years ago, it was going around Hollywood that was happening. I haven't seen the script yet, but man. Okay.
I could have sworn I heard your name mentioned in it.
Thank you. Good. Because you might be in some rooms I'm not in. That's a good thing. I love
the Lord.
Yeah. Speaking of scripts, Chris, with the writer's strike that's going on now, how, with you as a director, how does that affect you? One, and two, how do you think it affects the future of filmmaking as a whole? Where do you think the game is right now, and where do you think it's headed?
I think we're having a Napster moment. And I think it's completely, people can't imagine that the industry would change, right? But, you know, writer strike, for instance, right? I still get, ATL was 18 years ago. I still receive residuals from that, right? Because the business model was, okay, we saw it in the movies, now we see it on TV, now we see it in the airplane, now we see it in Africa. That's the way TV has always worked. Now it's streaming. So streaming for us too, for Directors Guild, for everybody is, well, no streamer wants it to ever go anywhere else. It's a subscription model.
Yeah.
This is only available here. So I think what we're looking at is going, wow, like, the business changed. What is it? How do you figure it out? It's the Wild Wild West to a degree. And I think there are some streamers who got it figured out, at least the best that it can be, but it will never be what it was.
What it was.
And I think just like with videos, it took a long time to go, maybe I should stop making horseshoes because they're driving cars around and there needs to be tires, mm-hmm. right? It's a long way to look at it, the way content is valued. So what is that? That's just what I'm telling you is just a realization I had recently. Maybe, you know, I've been so involved and so in the marketing and everything with Shooting Stars and the edit right up until it came out that I wasn't even really on the page. But then when I've been having some conversations, it's like, I don't quite understand the answer yet or what it means, you know? So to answer Quest's question, the world is not my oyster. You know what I mean? I don't think the world is an oyster for anybody right now because we don't know. The opportunities are shrinking, right? There's a statistic in the DGA that of every member that makes a feature film, 85% only make one.
Yeah.
This is before any of this, right? So that tells you how difficult it is to make a feature and how slim the opportunities are. 85% of the union makes one feature film and not another one.
It's the same. So, it's almost the same on the SAG side as well. Like on our side, it's like you have your Tom Cruises or whatever, but then the other 90% is, you know, people struggling to get commercials or whatever, you know.
That's why I be saying, Amir, you got to keep your ear to the street, because if you keep it in the bubble, you're going to think it's sweet. But it's people are out in L.A. Shit is changing and you feel it.
Yeah, it's tough, you know, but it's interesting, right? Because that's the thing. The thing about the business, even if once you're in it for a long time, for me is that every day there's the opportunity for possibility, right? And that can keep your motivation flowing. It can keep you wake up every morning, there's a possibility of writing that script or moving forward. But I think that what we have to look at are great examples of the business aspect of it. Mm-hmm. You know, when we look at Amir and how he does things, how we look at Tyler Perry and he does things, Lee Daniels, these guys who have Kenya Barris, these guys who have taken their talent, understood how it works in business and how to play the game. Mm-hmm. And me personally, I've always been leaning more towards the artist side, right? And having reps and agents and things and just happy to be able to be creative. Because at some point as a creative, you go, man, I couldn't live any other way. Like I couldn't have another job, you know what I mean? And that satisfaction of when something that you create connects to your audience, right? But I think that because of the way that the world and the technology is moving, there needs to be more of a focus on understanding the business, not even just from a Hollywood perspective, but from a Wall Street perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, how content is being valued, how the business model of subscriptions are different.
Yeah, all the streaming companies are kind of collapsing into one another, like with Max becoming HBO, becoming Max, and Showtime collapsing into Paramount. And it just reminds me a lot of what happened with major labels, like when you said about Napster moment. It reminds me of the same thing that happened with labels.
Well, sir, thank you. This is long overdue. The next time we're in Atlanta together, I'll treat you to Follies.
He's in LA. He's in LA.
I said the next time we're in Atlanta.
I'll hop on a plane though. No problem.
Okay.
There you go. Yeah, LA don't count.
Man. I just wanted to say, Chris, I really just appreciate your work, man, and I love the way just to watch how you is you. A lot of the directors I follow, my guy Seeth Man, who I'm sure you know, Seeth.
Seeth.
Yeah, Seeth. Yeah, the YC, Anthony Hemingway.
Anthony Hemingway.
Yeah, just a lot of y'all brothers, man. I'm just really proud to see y'all, like, you know, transition and just keep working, man. I just love what y'all do. So, respect. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, man. Respect.
Absolutely. That's what's up. On behalf of Sugar Steve and I'm Paid Bill and Fontigolo and Lightyear and the great Chris Robinson. Man. I love your work. I love your songs that you do with your brother Rich and all the Vicks Formula.
All right.
That's dope.
That was for Dustin. I just wanted to show it on the YouTube. There we go.
That's
right. We are on YouTube now. Damn.
Congratulations.
Yes. I still don't know how that works for us. We're still on our soft lunch. Anyway, this is great Chris Robinson, and we'll see you on the next go round, y'all. Peace.
My brother. Peace. Thank y'all.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Psst, there's a shortcut to platinum status at Shell, to saving 10 cents per gallon on every fill every day. Just fill up 6 times with Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline, and it's yours. Plus, you'll rejuvenate your engine. Get ready to level up performance, rewards, and savings. With continuous use in gasoline direct injection engine fuel injectors, platinum status is earned with 12 fill-ups over 3 months, 10-gallon minimum per fill-up at participating Shell locations. Terms apply. Visit fuelrewards.com/status.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Delve into the visceral world of hip-hop with the Gangsta Chronicles, hosted by MC8 and Big Steel. It's every Thursday,
y'all already know.
A podcast that aims to unravel the intricate tapestry of one of music's most influential and misunderstood subgenres, gangsta rap.
Let's go.
Gangsta Chronicles unpacks the evolution of this uniquely American art form, offering listeners a comprehensive understanding of the significance this genre holds. Listen to the Gangsta Chronicles on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.